And up here, we're going to be going through something different. And I thought it was something that would pertain to you guys, not pertain as in maybe necessarily you personally because you struggle with this, although I do think there probably are some of us that do struggle with this unknowingly. But more likely, it's because you've got family, you go to a school, you have friends, you have coworkers that are probably affected by this topic. And so I do want you to think from that perspective. But like I said, I do think there are some people in here that the more I'm going to talk about it, the more I describe what this thing is, you're going to find that you actually live and practice and think and talk like this thing that we're going to talk about here in just a second. And actually, I ended up calling it when I first introduced it a few weeks ago as the most popular religion in America. The most popular religion in America. I am curious. Does anybody remember what I said was the most popular religion in America? I think I did tell you guys. Oh, I said. Okay, well, good for you guys. You guys, that was a test. You were listening. Yeah. Yeah. So, in fact, some people may even say it's not actually a religion. Some people would actually call it more like a worldview. But nonetheless, this religion or worldview, they do not meet in a church. They don't have like a fancy name or even like a symbol or logo. It's not like an off branch of one particular religion. In fact, I would say it's sprinkled amongst all religions, particularly in Western society in America. And what I have called this, there's not a fancier way of saying it than what it's been coined as, and that is moralistic therapeutic deism. Moralistic, now you guys are like, oh yeah, he did say that. Uh-huh. That's right. It's so weird and unorthodox that once you see it, you're like, yeah, he did say that weird thing. So this will be our summer series for 2024, is we're going to unpack moralistic therapeutic deism. Now, today is going to be more of an introduction of, first of all, how do they even like discover moralistic therapeutic deism? Why do they even call it this? Why do you use those three terms to call it that? And what you're going to find out is some of you are very quickly going to find out that, again, some of your coworkers, some of your family members, some of your classmates, some of your friends, and even some of you guys may actually uphold to this religion known as moralistic therapeutic deism. I also said that it's more of like a worldview. Somebody tell me, what is a worldview? Just making sure you guys are actually being well taught these days. How you view the world. Sweet. Awesome. Very deep. I can tell you've had caffeine. Excellent. Does someone want to add to the profound answer that Alana gave us? All right, Grace, go ahead. So perspective is a part of it, but I think it's much deeper than perspective. I know some of you guys know, you weird classical conversations people. You guys know. You guys have known since you were like 4 years old. Okay, Thad? Man, public school right there. Yeah, look at that. Yeah. It is the way you view the world with your perspective that affects the way that you think, the way you act, the way you talk, the way you react. It is taking over everything. For instance, when something really, really bad, let's say a family member gets in a car wreck and you find out on the phone instantly, the way you react to the news that someone got in a car wreck will reveal your worldview. Now, that doesn't mean that if you're like, I believe in a Christian worldview, so I believe in God's sovereignty. So when I found out my family member was in a car wreck, I wasn't even sad because I have a strong belief in the sovereign. No, we are human. We've got emotions. But in the midst of your crying, in the midst of your worry, in the midst of your emotions, behind it all is your worldview. And that is the Lord's in control. The Lord is good. He knows what's right. Now, hopefully the people in this room would uphold to a what we call a biblical worldview. But according to recent studies, and these are recent studies like after COVID, after the pandemic, supposedly the amount of adults that actually hold to a biblical worldview is 6%. Only 6% of, I guess I should say, United States adults actually hold to a biblical worldview. A new piece of groundbreaking research by the Cultural Research Center, which they did this big study, which is what we're going to look at tonight, answers the question raised by the initial study. If American adults do not have a biblical worldview, then what is the dominant worldview among the other 94%? If only 6% takes a biblical worldview, then what are the other 94%? And when they first did this study back, they did a study in 2003. So many of you, I think all the students were not born yet. Jacob, I think you were around. Yeah, 2003? Okay, good, yeah. 2003, they did this study, and what they found out is there wasn't a worldview that was predominant. The more they started asking people questions, they were realizing that what they believed wasn't like definitely New Age, New Ageism, definitely wasn't secularism, definitely wasn't humanism. The answers they were giving was like a mishmash. It's almost like the dinner after Thanksgiving. It's like a mishmash of random things all thrown on a plate. And that's just kind of your meal. It's like, what are we having for dinner? We're having the random stuff we had yesterday, all kind of pushed together. And what they did is they did a half-hour-long personal interview with 2,000 young adults. And the Cultural Research Center study found that the most common worldview at the time they described as syncretism. Now, I'm not going to have you memorize or keep up with syncretism, but syncretism is the idea of like, it's a little bit of this, it's a little bit of that, it's a little bit, and they kind of mushed it all together, and they're like, that's the majority view. So at the time, they called it synchronism. That's the summary name for a desperate, irreconcilable collection of beliefs and behaviors that define those people's lives. It's a cut-and-paste approach to making sense. In fact, I would have called it like Frankenstein worldview. It's like piecing together the arm of this religion, the other arm of that religion, the leg of this worldview, the other leg of that worldview. It was like piecing together all these different ideas, and they smushed it together into this worldview. And in 2003, they're like, we don't know what to do with this. We have no idea what to do with all these young people that have just pretty much went to the buffet of worldviews, and they just grabbed a little bit of everything and threw it on their plate. No idea. Rather than developing an internally consistent and philosophical coherent perspective on life, that's another way of saying, instead of actually using your brain, young people, instead of actually using their brain, American young people embraced points of view or points of action that felt comfortable and convenient. That's what they did. They just grabbed on to bits of other religions that was comfortable and was convenient. Does that sound like young people today? Trying to be comfortable, trying to have life convenient. Those beliefs and behaviors are often inconsistent or even contradictory, but few Americans seemed troubled by those findings. A lot of people, when they saw this, when this came out in 2003, or maybe it came out the next year, 2004, people weren't like, oh my goodness, I can't believe we can't figure out what worldview they have. Most people just didn't care. They're like, ah, it's young people, it's new. The internet was kind of new as well. So it's just like, you know, we'll figure it out when we get there. And we're seeing now, what, 21 years later, we're seeing some very interesting things come out of this. But when they compiled all these answers, remember, 2,000 adults, a half-hour-long personal interview. So this wasn't like them filling out a survey, and then they sit in. It's like me sitting down with you for 30 minutes to have an interview, asking you questions about life, and me documenting all those answers. They took all those answers from 2,000 people, half-hour-long, stuck them into this machine to sort through them. And when they stuck it into this machine, the number one worldview that came out was, this is funny, it spit out none of the above. they were probably frustrated because they just did all this research and the number one thing to come out said none of the above. And so they're just like, we don't know what to do with this. These young people, they're either like making up answers and throwing us for a loop, or they're actually developing a brand new worldview. They created a brand new worldview, which I would argue is moralistic, therapeutic deism. So what they did is they now, so what they pretty much said, okay, let's just call this moralistic therapeutic deism, and whoever was leaning heavily or moderately in that direction. They put them in that group. And so this is actually, this is what their chart said. So that 39% used to be called none of the above because they didn't know what to do. But usually none of the above, like when you look at charts and surveys and stuff, usually none of the above is at the very bottom. It's like 1%, 2%, something very small. But for the first time ever, 39% would actually hold to worldview beliefs of moralistic therapeutic deism. You can see biblical worldview at the time was number two. That's pretty good too. Secular humanism. Y'all know what secular humanism is? I'm assuming that you guys know these big fancy words. Y'all look smart, but I don't really know for certain. Y'all know secular? Anybody want to? This is what teachers do when they don't know the answer. They're just like, who knows the answer out there? I know you guys know. Well, surprisingly, I know this one. Secular humanism is the idea that there is no God. The ultimate source of right and wrong, and the ultimate source of life in general is found in humans. There is no higher being. So that's secular humanism. Y'all know biblical worldview, right? Okay, just making sure. I'm getting nervous now. Nods, yes? Sweet, awesome. Postmodernism. Blake? Yeah, that's a good, Thomas, you want to add to that? Yeah, that's it. And what Blake said is right too. It's like, truth is relative. You can't find truth out there. Like, what is right and wrong? Oh, you can't know that. It's based on the person. This is actually what's happening right now to, rest in peace, Star Wars. So Star Wars is actually, because the new stuff that's coming out, I love it. Everyone's like, oh, trash. the new stuff that's coming out, if you notice, there are lines that are starting to come out from these movies, from their trailers and from their little teasers. It's like, there is no such thing as good or evil. There's only power. And everyone's like, what does that even mean? They don't know what it means. I barely know what it means. But what they're essentially saying is that, you know, slaughtering a bunch of kids in Jedi Temple is not evil. Just saying, it's just complicated. So, all that to say, postmodernism is up there. Y'all know what nihilism is? Nihilism? CCS is owning up right here. Good job, Thomas and Blake. John, you know what nihilism is? Yeah. Yeah. Nihilism is life is meaningless. There's no point in life. Just go and do whatever you want. That's nihilism, which was 10%. 10% of the young adults were just like, there's no point in life. Go eat Twinkies and go binge a TV show. Eastern mysticism, that's like, we're all gods and none of this is real. Almost like Matrix talk. That's my summary of that. And then Marxism. I'm not going to really get into that. Oh, Marxism, go ahead.
It's the original view of communism. Everything would work, we would all share everything, and everything would be absolutely perfect, but since this is a world, it will never work. Also, the graph adds up to 132.
And that's what happens when you give into a Marxist mentality. No, I'm just kidding. Hold on, 30, 46. Look, anyway, guys, look. Hey, just so you know, just to put myself in the clear, I hit copy and paste. Just saying, copy and paste. Thomas? Wait, shh, I can't hear Thomas. Go ahead. Yeah. So I would say a great way to kind of wrap your mind around Marxism is everything's through the vantage point of an oppressor and the oppressed. And that's how you can look at everything. And so we actually have, so a new modern version of Marxism that you're seeing today is critical race theory. That's Marxism. That's, again, there's an oppressor and there are the oppressed, and everybody falls into one of those two categories. So again, these are all worldviews, and they would have thought that biblical worldview would be number one, or maybe atheism, which is secular humanism, would be number two. But again, as they compiled these answers, number one was none of the above. But then once they actually read their responses, what they all had in common was a high view on moralism, a high view on therapy or therapeutic ideas, and deism, which is we're going to talk about, is just the belief in God. And so again, we're gonna walk through these things. Now, what they try to do is they try to look at who are all these people that are in this group, and these were the major groups. All those 2,000 people wrote down like what kind of group did they associate with. The groups that apparently associate with moralistic therapeutic deism were spiritual skeptics, LGBTQ supporters, political liberals, individuals who attend a predominantly Black or Hispanic church, individuals who attend predominantly, or sorry, who attend a Catholic church, and those people who are less likely to vote. I don't know why that last one's in there. Ultimately, the question is, who actually invented this religion? Who invented this group? Now, I know they coined it as I'm going to refer to it from now on as MTD, because I don't want to say those three words over and over and over. They coined it as that, but where did this even come from? And so George Barna, who does a lot of research, said worldviews in America are developed organically. Very few schools have teaching that focuses directly on a person's worldview. Very few adults know what a worldview is, much less what the worldview alternatives are. Kind of like some of y'all's faces when I was asking you worldviews. We have been shocked on how few Christian schools, as well as religious congregations, directly address the worldview issue. Put simply, it was created by our cultural, our cultural melting pot of ideas. Most adopt a worldview through the arts and entertainment. That's what one of these studies said, is that most people probably in this group at the top probably got it from entertainment and the arts. But ultimately, you could summarize it like this. Worldviews are caught like a cold and not really taught in education systems. You really aren't taught a worldview directly. It's more that it's caught like a cold over time. So a good question that you might be asking yourself is, why aren't kids going into Christian private schools or homeschool co-ops or homeschool environments or churches and youth groups? How come they're not going in, and then by the time they get to college, how come they're not coming out with biblical worldviews? Like, why is that number the biggest? This is what he says, which I thought was very interesting. He says, knowing a few Bible verses, attending church services, praying will not get the job done to come out with a biblical worldview. Attending a Christian school that offers a chapel service and a Bible class won't accomplish the task either. Going to church services that feature sermons drawn from biblical content is not sufficient to build a biblical worldview. Parents expecting their child to follow the Ten Commandments is not enough to develop a full-scale biblical worldview. Now, you hear all those things, you're like, man, those are good things though, right? Obeying the Ten Commandments, good, right? Going to church services that draw from the biblical content, those are good, right? But just because you throw your kid into the soil of all that biblical stuff doesn't guarantee they'll actually come out with a biblical worldview. Parents know this. Parents understand that just surrounding your kid with biblical stuff doesn't actually change their mind. It's about what they love. And just because you send them to church or you send them to church camp doesn't mean they're going to come back and love Jesus. It just might mean that they love having a good time with their friends. All those are token efforts that have proven inadequate towards developing an integrated body of belief and behaviors that enable someone to think like Jesus so they can live like Jesus. Our studies show that Americans are neither deep nor sophisticated thinkers. I like this. I think the person who said this was stepping on a lot of toes, so they didn't even say their name. They just said a veteran researcher. This veteran researcher noted this. Our studies show that Americans are neither deep nor sophisticated thinkers. Do we agree or disagree? Sweet. I'm glad you thought deeply about that. Americans have become selfish and emotion-driven. Agree or disagree? Absolutely. How do you feel about that? Okay. Americans are leaving logic and reason behind. Agree? To promote a way of life that pushes us to think more clearly, consistently, and purposely will take time and effort, and it will be uncomfortable, which I wholeheartedly agree. Most people seem more interested in living a life of comfort and convenience than one of logical consistency and wisdom. Wholeheartedly agree. And I would say that really what all those different people that ended up falling into that category, what they all have in common is they were lazy, they were self-centered, and it was convenient for them to live in that way. I would say that was it. People that are, and by the way, this can be people who would proclaim to be Buddhists. This is people who would claim to be Christian. These are people that would claim to be all sorts of different religions, but what they all have in common is within their own religions, they were self-centered, they were lazy, and they're only willing to reach for things that are convenient. They're not willing to work hard at their faith. They're holding out on their parents' faith, they're holding out on their school's faith, they're holding out on their youth group's faith, and they're not actually taking it upon themselves to make it personal on them. And so what happens to a whole generation? And this is pretty much what they found out. Ever since the 90s, which had a lot of pragmatism. Pragmatism is pretty much just, instead of like getting to like the heart of the issue, it's like, let's just make a bunch of programs and a bunch of different like check the box things for our young people to do to make them feel like they're doing church. What came out of that movement when they did this study in 2003 is a bunch of people that pretty much never learned how to think for themselves. And so thus was born moralistic therapeutic deism. So all I want to do tonight is I just want to go over what do those three words mean. That's it. And then at the very end, the last slide, it will actually reveal what the rest of the weeks are going to compile of. But let's look at each one. So first, let's talk about why moralistic. So what is a moralist? Or if you want to answer, what is morals? That's fine too. What does it mean to be moralistic or to have morals? What are morals in general? Wes? A set of beliefs you live by. Not quite. Public school, man. Sorry. It's okay. Okay, so what's right and what's wrong? Yeah, I would say what's right and what's wrong. What I put down here specifically, moralist, a person is someone that lives for goodness and rightness. And then I think there is an importance of putting the caveat on there, mostly in the public sphere. There is a connotation to someone who's a moralist. If you're going to call someone a moralist, is it good for someone to live for goodness? Yeah, absolutely. Is it right for someone to live for rightness? Absolutely. But the connotation here is what it says at the end, mostly in the public sphere. That means the reason why they love good, the reason why they chase after right things is for the attention of what's around them. For their parents, for their friends, for their boss, for their coworkers. It's for the stranger that sees you handing the cheeseburger to the homeless guy so you can do your little virtual signaling and pat yourself on the back. That's what's behind this idea of being a moralist. But it comes back to what Alana said. And moralists, someone who wants to stand up for goodness and rightness, the question is not like, well, how good are you doing at it? Are you doing it really well? The question comes back to, how do you define good and how do you define what's right? What would you say? If someone were to press you and say, well, you stand up for morals, you stand up for what's good, you stand up for what's right, you don't want to live in a way that's wrong, how do you define good and how do you define evil? Austin? So I would agree. So I'm going to press back. I'm the crazy guy you met on the street, and I'm going to press back a little bit and say, no, I agree. I think God knows what's right and what's wrong. But I think God would be okay with me stealing in order to feed my starving family. What do you think? What do you say to that? See how morals can be conflicting? Morals can be confusing. If you don't have a standard for right and wrong, it can get very murky very quickly. Anyone want to kind of mystically put yourself next to Austin in this hypothetical situation with the crazy man? All right. Wait, are you, did you want to rebuttal?
I would say
your rebuttal the first time was a whistle. So. Yeah, by the way, that's like one of the most famous moral thought activities that's out there is like, hey, if you're living in Germany and you're a Christian and the law says you have to turn over, I mean, that question has been regurgitated and men infinitely smarter than me have sat around a table for hours debating that question, which I will not do with you right now. Yeah, so all that to say is you have to get to a point of like, what is good and what is bad and who defines it? Who's the person that gets to decide what's right? Is it God? Some people say, yeah, but then you have to say, well, which God are you talking about? Because my God might be different than your God. Okay, how about this? What about government? Some people will say that right and wrong is dependent on the government. So again, just bringing up the topic of marijuana. Is it wrong? Some people's answer will be, well, it depends what state you live in. That's how people are thinking about it right now. That's how Christians are thinking about it right now. Some people, it's all about your community, like your group of friends or just the place that you live. Some people, it's like your little community that you found online in your little group chat. That's ultimately what decides what's right and what's wrong. And everyone else just has it wrong. And then, of course, the ultimate one, which I think everyone in this room has to battle every day, is you. It's your own heart that you're battling every single day about what's right and what's wrong. Some people actually think that right and wrong depends on whether or not you get caught. Is cheating wrong? Well, if I didn't get caught, it's not wrong. But the second you get caught, oh, yeah, it's wrong. It's wrong. It's wrong. But if you don't get caught, well, I mean, you know, if no one catches me, it's not a big deal. This is what happens when you let morals be based off of self instead of based off of a standard, which I would say is God's word. MTD believes that that central to living a good and happy life is being a good moral person. You know what this means? People, all those people that actually held to that worldview, they would say that MTD means be a nice person, a kind person, a pleasant person, respectful, responsible, working on self-improvement, taking care of one's own health, and doing one's best to be successful. Now, when you heard that list, some of you are probably thinking, I don't feel like those are bad things. Kinda, maybe, but it's about what's behind it. So the question ultimately is it wrong to be a moralist? Is it wrong to be a moralist? Being moral in this faith means being a kind of person who other people will like, fulfilling one's personal potential, and not being socially disruptive or interpersonally obnoxious. That's funny. That's if you were to like write the Bible of MTD, that would be some of the commandments there. It would say, make sure that people are like you by being kind to them, fulfilling your potential in life, and don't be socially disruptive, and please, whatever you do, do not be obnoxious. That's what they would say. So people who filled out the survey, that's what they thought was important in life, is don't do these things. And they would say, if they are abiding by those things, and they're not being obnoxious, and doing all this other stuff, ultimately, God is happy with them. If you're not obnoxious, God really likes that. So you could sum it up like this. God cares about you trying to be good, and God cares about you not being a jerk. As long as you're not a jerk, and as long as you're trying to be kind and good, God is really happy. So the question is God happy when you're not a jerk? I love how some of you are like deeply thinking about this. Like, Sarah Grace, you fell into the trap of nodding in public, which means that you have an answer. Oh, yeah, go ahead, Sarah Grace. He doesn't want us to be jerks. Okay, anybody disagree with Sarah Grace? Thad disagrees. Whoa, whoa, whoa. Come on, Thad. Don't be a jerk. Come on. Go ahead, Dad.
I think that greatly depends on how people define literature.
All right, hey, I'm gonna pitch a scenario, and I'm kind of saying it to you, but I'm kind of saying it to all you guys. Okay, you've got these plans with your friends. You've been waiting a long time. Here it comes. It's Friday night. You're getting ready, and then your parents don't let you go at the last minute. Are your parents being a jerk? Some of you are like, let me see if they're in the room first. Okay, they're not in the room. Yes, they're no. Are your parents being a jerk in that moment? Now, a lot of teens would say, absolutely. I've been planning for this for weeks. They knew they were planning that, and then they just ripped it out like a rug. They're a jerk. And then within this religion, you would be guilty. Ah, guilty, Mom. You better repent before MTD church on Sunday. Dad, did you have more that you wanted to say? Yeah. 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 Again, it goes back to what's right and what's wrong. Maybe your parents were in the right for actually withholding you from going to that thing. I'll say it this way. Some people would say it as simple as like MTD, the M is as simple as stay in your lane. As long as you stay in your lane, you're doing great. But the second you cross into someone else's lane, check your blind spot. What are you doing? And all of a sudden, things are getting out of hand. But here's the reality. In this life, you desperately need accountability. You need people to step into your life and correct you. And so the reality is that you're going to have people in your life like a boss or a friend or a teacher or a parent. Sometimes Mr. Bird, that is going to be, quote unquote, a jerk. Because I see you swerving all over the place spiritually, and I have to come in and be a jerk and be obnoxious for the sake of your soul. But for someone who holds to this religion, it's like, stay in your lane. Don't let people tell you what to do. As long as you're being a good person, that's fine. So I would say it's less about are you doing right and wrong, and it's more about the how and the why you do good. A lot of you in this room, if not all of you, do good. You're doing good things. You're helping your parents. Some of you tonight are going to be very kind to the upcoming seventh graders that were absolutely terrified to get out of their parents' car to come to youth group tonight. Some of you vividly remember that feeling. Some of you are like, it's been too long. I don't remember that. But I literally got to see a girl who was like trembling and her dad had to bring her in to youth group, and she is absolutely terrified. And so some of you, out of your kindness, are going to go and talk to that girl and try to make her feel welcome. Is that good? Absolutely. But the question is, why? Are you doing it because Mr. Bird just gave a speech about it during his talk? Or are you doing it because you genuinely have a love for other people? Are you doing things so people like look at you and say, oh man, they have a great, great reputation? Or are you doing it to please the Lord? It's a tough question. Your motives are polluted all the time with your own selfish endeavors. But someone who holds to MTD, they're doing it in the public sphere so they can get public credit, so people can think of them highly and give the credit to them. So ultimately, we should stand up for what's right. We should obviously praise those who do good. We should strive to obey the commands of the Bible. But it's all about doing it how? According to the Bible, according to his spirit, dependent on his strength. And what's the reason why? It's an offering of thanks to God's mercy in your life. You live knowing that you can never be good enough, and you live as a slave of Christ, doing his will and not your own. Because here's the reality, guys. If you know someone, and people struggle with this all the time, especially when you guys get to college, you're going to meet people that are super kind, really friendly, the most laid-back, easygoing person, and yet they don't believe in God. And your world's going to be like, what do I do with this? I don't have a category. Because I was taught that all atheists hate the world. And you're going to meet someone that is not your worldview, and yet they're very, very kind, and you're going to be sitting there struggling with, what do you do with that? Well, you got to remember that it's not about the external, it's about what's on the inside. And I would say that even whoever, I mean, if we took a vote in this room and I said, who's the most moral, kind, good person in this room, and everyone started filling out ballots, what I would tell you is, if that person doesn't know God, that morality is worthless. Who cares if they're the most kind person? Who cares if they have a reputation of being the most kind with their money and their time and their words? If they don't know God, it doesn't mean anything. Morals are worthless without Christ. And someone who holds to moralistic therapeutic deism, as one lady puts it, it's like the golden rule Christianity. It's all about do unto others as you would want people to do to you. It's a theological fuzzy form of Christianity that honors moral practice more than the specific belief. Or, I like this better, they love the practice of God's law rather than worshiping the lawgiver himself. I think Aaron, if you were at summer camp, Aaron talked about this. The people that get more excited about actually doing the stuff of church and doing the stuff of Christianity instead of actually loving God himself. Do not fall into that. And if you are guilty of that, then you are already demonstrating some habits of moralistic therapeutic deism. If you could sum it up like this, I would say what an MTD person is when it comes to this word is MTD is about perceived good. That's what you care about. That's really what you care about. You just want people to perceive you as a good person. You want people to perceive you as a moral person. You want people to perceive you as super kind, super generous, great person, someone that's easy to be around, easygoing, and that's what you care about. That's ultimately what matters, is how you're perceived, not what's actually on the inside. You want a great test? You want a great test to see if this, if you're guilty of this? Do you give your best when you come into these public settings, but then when you get home, you kind of turn into your Mr. Hyde? Do you come and bring your best, and you're so kind, you're so easygoing, so respectful, and then when you get home, well, look, I'm not trying to impress anybody here. Y'all know who I am. And so you go, you know, claws out, no more being good, no more caring about that. Who cares? That's a great test to see. Are you driven by the fear of man? Are you driven by wanting the praise of men? Or, in which we're going to talk about the opposite of these things on another day, but are you doing it to please the Lord? So perceived goodness. Let's talk about therapeutic. This is the second one. What is therapeutic? These are my chances for me to drink because I've got the camp crud, remember? So you can either define therapeutic or you can define therapy. If you happen to know the word therapy. Therapy or therapeutic? Okay.
So I think it's the idea of being comforted due to your past experiences, and like just in general being comforted and having sympathize with you,
okay.
Make you feel comfortable, make you feel better about something that you quote unquote went through that quote unquote wants back.
Gotcha. So what I would define that as is postmodern therapy. It's a very specific version of therapy. That is actually, instead of getting them to think differently about something, it's instead to say, actually, you're doing everything right. Everyone else is the problem, so it'll be okay. Pat them on the back. Here's a warm cup of coffee. You'll do fine. You know, and that's kind of, so I would say it's a very specific form of therapy, but therapy in general means something a little bit more. Emma Grace? Yeah. Yeah, so you're similar to what Tim said, but it's taking another step towards fixing. So let me give you an example. When I say there's different forms of therapy, there's such thing as speech therapy. I was in speech therapy. I could not say R's and I could not say L's. And so when I said to my teacher, let's go to lunch, it was very awkward. And so I had to go to speech therapy. There's also such thing as physical therapy. What is physical therapy? Sarah Grace. Ah, a correction. Very good. There's a correction. So physical therapy, something is off. I also had to do physical therapy because I broke my hand when I was 19. I had to sit in a room with a lady and pick up rice for like 30 minutes. I don't know how that helped with anything, but me and Rice got to know each other very well. So there's physical therapy. Thomas, were you going to say something? Okay, yeah, so there's physical therapy, speech therapy, mental therapy is kind of what they're talking about, even academic therapy, but we don't call it academic therapy, we call it academic counselors. It's people that you're, again, there's a corrective aspect to it. Now, so I would say this, I would say therapeutic is the idea of bring someone to a standard. That's therapeutic. It's bringing someone to a goal, a standard, to completion, okay? So speech therapy mostly worked for me. There's still a couple words I apparently don't know how to say that my wife has to let me know of from time to time. Apparently I say that ice melts instead of melts, which she thinks is hilarious. So apparently things are supposed to be corrected to a standard. Physical therapy is supposed to end when you have recovered completely back to the way things are. So that's fine for academics because you're going from F to A, or maybe some of you, it's like, I'm just shooting for a C, come on. And so physical therapy, it's easy because there's a standard. Your hand could not do this, your foot could not do this, but now it can, therefore you may go. Speech therapy, the same thing. But mental therapy is a little bit more tricky. How do we know what the standard is for mental therapy? What is the ultimate place you're trying to get to mentally, emotionally, where it's like, sweet, you're good now, you don't have to see me anymore. Emma Grace, what do you think? Okay, the standard of your morals, so that means that the therapist would probably have to ask you what is right and wrong. But I'm going to go a step further and say that it's a much simpler answer. So again, you stop going to physical therapy when your hand is back to normal. When do you stop going to mental therapy, Dad? Say it again. When you feel good, or another way of saying it, Austin, function well. Eh.
Well, when you can stay okay.
Say it again. Oh, that's it, Hannah. I heard it like in the distance. That's it. You want to know what this is all about? Why they add the word therapeutic into this worldview? It's about happiness. That's it. People are living their life trying to be nice people. Stay in your lane, and your goal is to be happy every single day. When you wake up, your goal is to be happy. If the breakfast you got was not your favorite, you're totally allowed to complain about it or to throw it in the trash, because remember, your goal is happiness. Everything is about happiness. And in fact, I would say that it's about happiness, it's about enjoyment, and it's about peace. In fact, that's the word that a lot of therapists will use. Like, are you at peace with that decision? Are you at peace? Really what they're saying is like, are you happy? You happy now? That's what they're trying to figure out. And of course, this is very conflicting because it goes back to what Emma Grace said about trying to figure out your good and evil. But we're in a secular world that's relative. Each person has their own goals. Each person has their own standards. Each person has their own expectations. And actually, if you think about it, this is a little side tangent, but like, there's totally money all wrapped up. How many of you have seen a BetterHelp ad? Yeah, everybody. Those BetterHelp ads are all over the place. Listen to what, this is BetterHelp's. I went on BetterHelp just to read their website. Even when I went on there, they're like, do you need help? Are you sad? I was like, no, I'm fine. I just want to get a definition. BetterHelp said this. During therapy sessions, the therapist can guide clients towards insight and advice about changing thought processes and behaviors to improve mental health and reduce unwanted symptoms. Now, that's a lot of mumbo jumbo, for our goal is to make you happy and to get rid of things in your life that make you unhappy. That's their goal. And let me tell you, it's a great opportunity for money, because if they are happy, you've done your job and they're so thankful. Here, take my cash. I'm so happy. How long does that happiness last? Yeah, maybe 4 minutes down the stairs, and then, you know, something happens and you're like, man, that person just gave me a weird look. They must hate me. I wonder if my outfit's awful. Oh, I hate my life. I'm ugly. And then you're going back up the stairs. And it's just like, take my money again. I'm not happy. And it is a great business if you're wanting to get lots and lots of never-ending money. In fact, most therapists' goal is to not have an end date. Their goal is to just consistently meet with you for, wait for it, the rest of your life. The rest of your life. My older brother is currently in therapy. He is not a believer. I asked him the question recently, when do you think you'll be done with therapy? And he's like, well, are we ever done? And I was like, I know that sounded profound in your head, but it wasn't. I'm like, shouldn't you be working towards a goal of not needing therapy? He's like, well, Caleb, we all need therapy. I was like, okay, all right. See you Thanksgiving. Yeah. But this is the world we're living in. It's all about being happy. Some of you, you wake up every day and your goal is to be happy. As long as you're not being a bad person while doing it, it's totally cool. You're fine. This is what the book said specifically about this. It says the therapeutic label emphasizes the importance of feeling satisfied, fulfilled, and happy. This, talking about MTD, this is not a religion of repentance of sins. Why would you need to repent from sins? Sins are just a symptom that you need to get rid of and ultimately pursue happiness. It's not a religion of keeping the Sabbath. It's not a religion of living as a servant of a sovereign God. It's not a religion of steadfastly saying one's prayers. It's not one of faithful observing holy days or building character through suffering or basking in God's love and grace or spending oneself in gratitude and love for the cause of helping others. Rather, this is what they said. Now, this is good. Listen. What appeared to be the actual dominant religion amongst United States teenagers is centrally, primarily this, feeling good and feeling secure and at peace. That's your goal. It is about obtaining subjective well-being, being able to resolve problems, and getting along kindly with others. So when they did this survey, and they asked those 2,000 people, and remember, these are 30-minute conversations back and forth. This is what, I'm just going to read you a couple of their answers about that. All they did is ask them, describe your faith to me. That's all they said. I want you to listen to some of these answers. These are interesting. One 15-year-old Protestant girl said this, God is like someone who is always there for you. I don't know. It's like God is God. He's just like somebody that always helps you go through whatever you're going through. When I became a Christian, I was just praying and it always made me feel better. End quote. I'm trying not to say these with like a Valley Girl kind of accent, but. So here's a quote from a 14-year-old Jewish girl. I guess for me, Judaism is more about how you live your life. Part of the guidelines are like how, all the likes in this. Part of the guidelines are like how to live and I guess be happy with who you are. Because if you're out there helping someone, you're going to feel good about yourself, you know? How about this? 15-year-old Buddhist girl. When I pray, it makes me feel really good afterwards because that's what's most important. Here's a 15-year-old conservative from Texas. I don't know why they added Texas, but 15-year-old conservative girl from Texas. Religion is very important because you have no one else to talk to about stuff. You can just get it off your chest. You can just go and talk to God, and that's good. One more. This is a 14-year-old East Indian Hindu girl. It's all girls. I don't know why. I've read other ones where it was boys. I guess this one was all girls. When asked about her faith, this is what she said. I don't know. They just really helped me feel good. That was her summary of her faith. It just makes me feel good. It is thus no wonder that so many religious and non-religious teenagers are so positive about religion, for the faith many of them have in mind effectively helps them achieve personal life goals. They're using religion to make them happy. It's all about self. It's not about worshiping a God. It's not about giving everything to him. It's not living like presenting yourself as a perfect and living sacrifice. It's about you. How does church make you feel? When you come to church, are you sitting there wrestling through like, oh man, it's that teacher today? Ugh. When you leave Sunday school, did you not get to spill as much tea as you wanted? Sorry, that was a call out to, yeah, I know. Miss Henry knows. We've talked about spilling the tea. But I'm just saying, it's a great question to ask. Do you come to church with expectations that all fit you? Or are you coming to say, what can I offer to God? Which is worship and living rightly before him. There's nothing wrong with spilling tea, by the way. To feel good and happy about oneself and one's life. And, I mean, that's the primary goal, is to feel good and happy about oneself. Is therapy bad? Well, no, it's about what is the goal. That's why we have biblical counseling at our church. We have biblical counseling. Biblical counseling is not for you to sit around on a long couch and prop up your feet and share your feelings. And we're like, it's okay. You'll be fine. Biblical counseling is, again, it's going back to the standard. What is the standard? You're here. What are the things in your life that are keeping you from getting to the standard that God has placed? Ultimately, if it's for happiness, peace, and satisfaction, I would say you're headed down the wrong route. But again, many of us are stuck there. So MTD is about finding self-fulfillment through religion. You use religion, you use your faith just to make you happy. Now, some of you are like, I don't know about that. Well, let me ask you this. Do you go to church just to keep your parents off your back? There you go. You're using it for your own happiness. If I can keep mom and dad off my back, then I'm happy. Therefore, I go to church. All right, last one, which should be the simplest, moralistic, therapeutic deism. What is a deist? It's someone who believes in God, who created the world, but is uninvolved. I actually think the word deist has changed for 21st century versus what it was in the 18th century. Because they would say that God is uninvolved. I would disagree. The current definition is God is conveniently involved. And they would say is conveniently uninvolved at other times. Pretty much, if you're happy and everything's going well, God is uninvolved. However, if you're sad, if you're angry, if things are not going well and you pray to God, that's when God conveniently comes down to help you out. People who are holding to MTD, that's how they look at God. Simply believing in God exists cannot be enough. It's a lot more than head knowledge. They would say this. They would say that MTD is about the belief in a particular kind of God, one who exists, who created the world. He defines general moral order, but no one who is particularly personally involved in one's affairs, especially affairs in which one would prefer God not to be involved in. When you're enjoying time with your friends and maybe doing things that are a little sketchy and you probably shouldn't do it, this God conveniently doesn't intervene because God is like, well, no. If you're happy, that's fine. No, go ahead. It's not a big deal. As long as you're not a really bad person. I mean, if you're like a really bad person, I would step in. But yeah, you're not that bad. That's how they view God. But then when things go really, really bad, that's when they're like crying out to him, like, please, please, God, please help me. Please, God. Oh, please. You know, those are the, I used to have those prayers where I got in serious trouble and my dad had me go sit on the bed. And like, I knew there was, I mean, I'm pretty sure he like waited purposely outside the door just to make me sweat longer. And those are the moments where I'm like praying, like, Lord, please, Lord, please, Lord, I'm so sorry. I'll never do it again, God. Please, please don't make it hurt, you know? And I'm just sitting there like, conveniently, like when I was doing whatever sin I was doing, I didn't want God to step in. I knew what I was doing. I was happy. But then all of a sudden I'm in trouble and I'm like, hey, God, hey, so sorry I kind of ignored you the last week, but I really need you right now. And that's how you think about God. If someone who's a deist, that's how they think of God. Conveniently uninvolved when you're happy and then conveniently involved when you desperately need him. Most of the time, God, the God of this faith, keeps a safe distance. This God is not demanding, and actually, according to this religion, God can't be demanding, since his job is to solve your problems and to make you feel good. That kind of God wouldn't be demanding. Listen to how one 15-year-old boy from California put it, talk about his religion. He says this, quote, "God is like an entity that decides when or if he wants to intervene with a lot of things. To me, God is pretty much like intervention, like extreme luck. Say you're $50 away from something and you find $50 on the floor. Then that's probably God's intervention or something like that. But other than that, it just seems like he's monitoring the world. He just kind of stays back and he watches, like he watches a play or he watches a movie, like he's the producer or the director of the movie. He makes the movie all possible, and then he watches it. If there's something that he doesn't like, he jumps in and changes it." End quote. That's how he looks at God, like a director watching a play, and he's just enjoying it, and then if something's off, he's going to jump in and help. But then after that, he just steps back and watches. That's how he looks at it. For many teens, as with adults, God sometimes does get involved in people's life, but usually only when they call upon him, mostly when they have some trouble or problem or they have a bad feeling. In this sense, deism here is revised from the classic 18th century version of with the therapeutic qualifier, making a distant God selectively available to take care of your needs. I'll say this. Here's one more quote from a 14-year-old boy from Colorado who's a Protestant, an evangelical. He says, "I believe there is a God. So sometimes when I'm in trouble or in danger, then I'll start thinking about that." Like the deist God of the 18th century philosophers, the God of contemporary teenage moralistic therapeutic deism is primarily a divine creator and lawgiver. Listen to this. In short, God is like a combination of a divine butler and a cosmic therapist. Someone that holds to MTD or that type of thinking, God is a divine butler. Pretty much when you pray, how often are your prayers asking for things? You are making God a divine butler. How often are you running to him when things are bad? You are making God a cosmic therapist. It's more than head knowledge. It's belief that is proven by action. And I would say if you could really summarize what MTD is when it comes to deism, MTD is about God serving us. It's about God serving us. It's about being perceived as good. It's about finding self-fulfillment through your religion. And it's all done by God serving you. Now, like I said, I think some of you might have let some of these things trickle into your actions and in your motives. But you probably have lots of people in your life that really hold to this. God is a cosmic butler and a cosmic or a divine butler and a cosmic therapist. Really quickly, let me just end with this. Is MTD working? Yes and no. Yes, as in the fact of it's working in the sense that it is super contagious and spreading. It's the path of least resistance. It's such an easy religion to hold to. You get to appease your conscience because you believe there's a God, so you feel good about that. But ultimately, what you're banking on is a God that's going to bail you out when things are not going well. It's contagious in the Western society, and it's, of course, a reason why it's so vibrant in America is because it's fed by freedom and ease. The more easy life gets and the more freedom we get, the more MTD is going to grow and spread. One person said it like this: most youth seem to accept MTD as their as all there is. And all there is nice to have, almost like a bank account, something you want before you go to college in case you need to draw money from it sometime. It's like their version of religion where I can go to college and I can go and enjoy my life. And just in case I run out of money, I can draw upon my religion if things go bad. But of course, what we have not told those young people is that faith is bankrupt. There's no money in that bank. So is it working? I would say from a worldly perspective, it's spreading, but ultimately, and y'all already know this, the reason why it's no is it doesn't lead to true fulfillment. In this life, you will reap what you sow. You can't just keep loving your sin and getting out of it through your cosmic butler. And then ultimately, after this life, your life will be summed up as idolatrous religion. You know why? Because you will find out that in your morals, in your seeking of happiness, and in your head knowledge of a God that wants to serve you, ultimately, you've been bowing down to a very familiar statue. And that very familiar statue you've been bowing down to is the statue of yourself. You've been bowing down to yourself for years. You're only good because people give you the credit. You're only seeking what makes you happy. And you only believe in a God because your God serves you at the drop of a dime because you only use him for your own wants. And so when these people 21 years ago coined the term MTD, they pretty much took all their responses and they came up with really five summary statements, but I call it the doctrinal creed of MTD. And so this is what we're going to look at over the next coming weeks. So we're going to look at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then week 7, we're going to do like, what does the Bible say? We're going to talk about the Bible all throughout it, but I'm going to give you like, what is the actual biblical state at the very end? And then week 8, I'll tell you that in just a second. But here we go. Number 1, a God exists who created and ordered the world and watches over human life on earth. Now, some of you will be like, wait, I believe that. Just wait. Number 2, God wants people to be good, nice, and fair to each other as taught in the Bible and by most world religions. Number 3, the central goal of life is to be happy and to feel good about oneself. Number 4, God does not need to be particularly involved in one's life except when he needs to resolve a problem. And then number 5, good people go to heaven when they die. And that's a big one. And that's what they actually believe. And guess who's in that group? The majority of the people. Most people are good. So most people go to heaven. Only murderers, rapists, the really bad people. That's who goes to hell. But everyone else goes to heaven. And so what they do is they actually go through these five things, which is the five things we're going to go through. And then, like I said, the last one we're going to, week 7, we're going to really just look at scripture to say, what is the opposite of this? How do we know it's a biblical religion? And then week 8, I'm doing something a little bit different. We're going to have a Q&A at the very end, but what I'm going to do, and I should have mentioned it at the very beginning, but it's an intro lesson, so I guess it's not that bad. But I will say this, you guys are probably going to have questions as I'm talking, and I'm not opposed to answering questions as we go through. Some of it's in the flow. It makes sense to answer the question, but as you're listening to me next week, the week after that, the week after that, if you think of a really good question, maybe it's just personal to you or whatever it is, write it down in your notebook, wait till the end, and I'll put this up every single week at the very end. And just real quick, just pull up your phone, or you can ask me for my phone or ask someone else for their phone, because it doesn't ask you for a name. It's just scanning the, you hold up the camera, the QR, it takes you straight to the website, type in your question, hit submit, and it's done. You can even hit submit and it says, want to ask another question? Like, absolutely. You can go click there and ask another question. So so the last week we'll do a Q&A. So submit questions all along the way. If you don't have any today, that's totally fine. But let me pray. And then I'm just going to say one quick announcement after that. And then we're going to go out there. All right. So let's pray.